Up in the piney woods, they were making moonshine, dodging the government revenuers who hunted them between the trees like wild game. Each dawn, the hollers echoed with the news they had survived another night. These cries were set to music, Blue Ridge and Bluegrass, the voice of the people.
A lot of these men not coming home tonight when the work whistle blows.
Then they headed for the mines. The coal beneath their homes wasn't going to walk into the daylight by itself. It had to be dynamited loose, hacked out, shoveled out. Load by load, man and boy, it had to be dragged to the surface. Down south, meanwhile, it was King Cotton and the Chain Gang. The songs dripped with sweat this time, and heavy to match the Delta heat and boggy fug. At night, they plucked the banjo and slapped away the stings of another backbreaking day spent sharecropping another man's land. Out in Oklahoma, meanwhile, the folks simply fled. Their land stripped to bare dust, they took to the road, to the rails, to the wind. Like yesterday's news, they blew along the byways to the four corners of the nation. Always looking for a hand up, sometimes reduced to a handout, seeking a melody to match their flat iron twang, a voice for their homeless lyrics. Most headed west. One was named Guthrie, Woodrow Wilson Guthrie.
I just blowed in and I got them Dust Bowl blues. I just blowed in and I got them Dust Bowl blues. I just blowed in and I'll blow back out again.
Uprooted from the heartland, Woody Guthrie would take the pulse of the nation and set it to the rhythm of the rails. Migrant and restless, hard traveling would tune his senses to the plight of his country and its people. On the anvil of the land he traveled, he would pound the ringing hammer of cold truth and give voice to the very wind that blew them from their homes. From California to New York, they were the songs of freedom and justice, and they would redound from shore to shore.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island. The Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a walk in that ribbon of highway, I saw above me that endless skyway, saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for you and me.
Welcome to From the Vault, an original series produced by the Pacifica Radio Archives. This week, celebrating the life and times of Woody Guthrie.
And I was born there on July the 14th, 1912, year that President Woodrow Wilson was nominated.
Alan Lomax from the Library of Congress.
What did your family do? What kind of people were they? Where'd they come from?
Well, they come in there from Texas in the early day. My dad got to Oklahoma right after statehood. He was the first clerk of the county court in Okemo, Oklahoma, after statehood. He is known as the one of them old hard-hitting, fist-fighting Democrats, you know, that run for office down there, and they used to miscount the votes all the time. So every time that my dad went to town, it's common the first question that I ask him when he come riding in on a horse that evening, I'd say, "Well, how many fights do you have today?" And then he'd take me up on his knee, and he'd proceed to tell me who he is fighting and why and all about it.
Put him there, boy. We'll show these fascists what a couple of hillbillies can do. Well, I'm gonna tell you, fascists, you may be surprised. People in this world are getting organized. You're bound to lose. Fascists bound to lose.
Woo! All
million fascists died, you're bound to lose. You fascists bound to lose.
Where did you live, on a farm?
Well, no, I was born there in that little town. My dad built a six-room house, cost him about $7,000 or $8,000, and the day after he got the house built, it burned down.
Kind of a place was Okemah. How big was it? Well, you remember it when you were a kid.
Well, in them days, his little town, about 1,500, and then 2,000. A few years later, it got up to about 5,000. They struck some pretty rich oil pools all around there. Garrison City and Slick City and Cromwell and Seminole and Bowlegs and Sand Springs and Spring Hill and all up and down the whole country there. They got oil, got some pretty nice oil fields around Okemah there.
Did any of the oil come in your family?
No, no. We got the grease. Didn't get no oil.
Keep my skillet good and greasy when I'm gone, gone, gone. Keep my skillet good and greasy when I'm gone.
Well, what kind of people lived in Okemah?
Oh, just sort of a farming class of people. The town didn't amount to much except on a Saturday, you know, when all the farming people would come in there to have a trades day or give away a new buggy and a box of tobacco or buy them a new pair of button shoes or some such stuff as that. It's always big Saturday. All the farmers would all come to town, had a big time celebrate, but the population, the people that live there, right now, it's about 1/4 Indians and 1/4 Negroes and 1/2 white.
Do all those people mix on pretty equal terms or not? How does it go?
Well, no. Not what I'd call equal terms. There's been a lot of shooting scrapes and fights. But anyway, that there are some crazy way they've got of looking at the colored situation. Ever since I was a kid growing up, I've always found time to stop and talk to these colored people because I found them to be full of jokes, what I mean, and wisdom. I learned how to play a French harp off a boy that shines shoes down there. I was passing a barbershop one day when I was about 15 or 16 years old, and there's a boy, a big barefooted boy, up laying in there, and he was playing the harmonica. He was playing the Railroad Blues.
How did you people live out there in Oklahoma? Did you live pretty well?
Well,
a place to sleep. How was it?
I don't know, Alan. To start with, I was a little bit different from. I wasn't in the class that John Steinbeck called the Okies because my dad, to start with, was worth about $35,000 or $40,000, and he had everything hunky dory. Then he started having a little bad luck. In fact, our whole family had a little bit of it. I don't know whether it's worth talking about or not. I never do talk it much. But then when this six-room house burned down that I told you about, just a day or two after it was built, it was supposed to be one of the biggest, finest in that whole country. Well, right after that, my 14-year-old sister either set herself afire or caught a fire accidentally. There's two different stories got out about it. Anyway, she
was having a little difficulty with her school work, and she had to stay home and do some work, and she caught a fire while she was doing some ironing that afternoon on the old kerosene stove. It was highly unsafe and highly uncertain in them days, and this one blowed up, caught her a fire, and she run around the house about twice before anybody could catch her. Next day, she died. And my mother, that was a little bit too much for her nerves or something. I don't know exactly how it was. But anyway, my mother died in the insane asylum at Norman, Oklahoma. Then about that same time, my father mysteriously, for some reason or other, caught a fire. There's a lot of people say that he set himself afire. Others say that he caught a fire accidentally. I always will think that he'd done it on purpose because he'd lost all his money, lost his hog ranch. He used to raise some of the best Poland, China, pure blood hogs in that whole country, and had something proud to work for, and felt like that he was part of the world and that he was doing some good and working hard. All of my brothers and sisters, I got another sister and two brothers, and they all felt pretty good until all these things happened and they found themselves scattered. All us kids had to scatter out and be adopted by different families. I lived with a family of people. There was 11 of us. Lived in a little two-room shack. I lived with these people several years. Their name is Sam White and his family, and he still lives within about a half a block of the same old house that he lived in them days. And in the old house with 11 of us sleeping in two rooms, why, we had two or three beds, you know, and so we'd sleep, some of us at the head and some of us at the foot, and had everybody's feet and everybody's faces, you know how that is. And then after that, I don't know, I kind of took to the road. I hit the road one day, the first day that I ever hit the highway, to be what's called a rambling man or a hobo or a tramp was in 1927.
It's hard to be parted from those that we love when reverses in fortune have come. The world's strongest heartstrings are broken in twain by the absence of loved ones and home. Goodbye to my stepson, goodbye to my home. God bless the ones that I leave with a sigh. The fields will be whitening and I will be gone to ramble this wide world alone. Bad, and I ain't gonna be treated this way. Sleep, you weary hobo. Let the towns drift slowly by. Listen to the steel rails humming. That's a hobo's lullaby. Oh,
not think about tomorrow. Let tomorrow come and go. Tonight you've got a nice warm boxcar, safe from all this wind and snow. I know the police cause you trouble. They cause trouble everywhere. But when you die and go to heaven, you'll find no policeman there. So go to sleep, you weary hobo. Let the towns drift slowly by. Listen to the steel rails humming. That's a hobo's lullaby.
When all of this dust started blowing up in the Texas oil fields, why, these people's houses wasn't built to keep out all this dust. So every morning when you'd wake up, why, you'd see where the dust had drifted in through the cracks in your house, and it just lit all over the floor and made ripples and drifts all over the floor of your house, and wherever the drafts of air went from one crack through all the rooms of your house, why, when you woke up in the morning, there'd just be a big drift of dust in your house, and your hair and your eyes and your whole face that stuck out from under the cover would be just covered up with dust, and all of the combs and brushes and things on your dresser would be covered up with dust. And breathing that dust, naturally, there was lots of people took down with a sickness that was called the dust pneumonia.
I got that dust pneumonia in my lung. I got the dust pneumonia in my lung. And I'm gonna sing this dust pneumonia song. I went to the doctor, and the doctor said, my son. I went to the doctor, and the doctor said, my son, you got that dust pneumonia, and you ain't got long, not long. Now there ought to be some yodeling in this song. And there ought to be some yodeling in this song. But I can't yodel for the rattling in my lung. My good gal sings the dust pneumonia blues. My good gal sings the dust pneumonia blues. She loves me 'cause she's got the dust pneumonia too.
Well, now you see this picture here. It shows you the big dust storm coming up. And, you know, just to see a thing that kind coming towards you, you wouldn't know exactly what it was, because it's a freak-looking thing. You never saw anything like it before, but we all sat there. We had seen dust storms of every other different color, flavor, description, style, fashion, shade, design, model. But anyway, I remember the particular evening of April the 14th, 1935, that this dust storm here blowed up. I was standing, a whole bunch of us was standing, just outside of this little town here that you see. And so we watched a dust storm come up like the Red Sea closing in on the Israel children. Anyway, we stood there and watched the son of a gun come up. And I'm telling you, it got so black when that thing hit, we all run into the house, and all the neighbors had all congregated in different houses around over the neighborhood.
We sat there in a little old room, and it got so dark that you couldn't see your hand before your face. You couldn't see anybody in the room. You could turn on an electric light bulb, a good, strong electric light bulb in a little room just about the size of this studio here. And that electric light bulb hanging in the room looked just about like a cigarette a-burning. And that was all the light that you could get out of it.
I've seen the dust so black that I couldn't see a thing. I've seen the dust so black that I couldn't see a thing. And the wind so cold, boy, it nearly cut your water off. I've seen the wind so high that it blowed my fences down. I seen the wind so high that it blowed my fences down. Buried my tractor 6 feet underground. Well, it turned my farm into a pile of sand. Yes, it turned my farm into a pile of sand. I had to hit that road with a bundle in my hand. These dusty blues are the dustiest ones I know. These dusty blues are the dustiest ones I know. Buried head over heels in the black old dust. I had to pack up and go, and it just blowed in. And I'll soon blow out again.
So we got to talking, you know, and a lot of people in the crowd that was religious-minded, and they was up pretty well on the scriptures, and they said, well, boys, girls, friends and relatives, this is the end.
So these people believed that the world had come to the end, huh?
Yep.
Were the women crying and screaming and going on?
No, Alan, you'd be surprised. They wasn't.
Wasn't nobody in that whole crowd is that way. And you see, the real thing, right face to face with you, why, most people are pretty level-headed.
Woody's longtime friend, actor Will Geer.
I was here doing a picture called A Fight for Life with the United States Film Service at Pere Lorentz. And we lived here on Fuller Avenue, just off Sunset. It was sort of a mecca at that time for all sorts of ballad singers. Burl Ives, that I had met in New York, played in Journeyman with me, came back and sang in Journeyman. He was here, and we'd meet together and sing songs with Eddie Albert. And we've especially heard Woody sing, "It Takes a Worried Man to Sing a Worried Song."
Takes a worried man to sing a worried song. Takes a worried man to sing.
Eddie Albert and a group of us went down and got him at the radio station, brought him up the house, and he sang songs there for us. That time we were getting ready to, for the picture to come to a finish, and we hired his wife. Woody Guthrie's wife was pregnant at that time, his first wife, Mary, and already had two girls, and she was pregnant by the boy, William, Will. So she worked in the picture with us, along with my wife, and we his first real salary came from the United States Film Service, which is rather indicative. Later on, he worked for the United States government, too, writing all those songs were up in Oregon. So his very first job that paid anything outside of almost a collection fee, just taking up collections by the hat or a very small fee for a booking or something of that sort, came from the United States Film Service and a film called Fight for Life. And I can still see Woody sitting on the steps waiting for the baby's cry inside the house, supposedly, little William being born. And they had trouble with his hair in the makeup department. His hair was very stiff and it went up unusually high. They tried ironing it down. They got a lady hairdresser in. They worked on it until they got his hair down so it looked reasonably unsensational. And that was his first part, waiting for his wife to give birth in a picture called Fight for Life.
You're listening to an original series produced by the Pacifica Radio Archives, celebrating the life and times of Woody Guthrie.